Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gip.
We usually begin the show with emails, almost always. We love your emails. This week is different because there was so much good science.
There's no room
for email.
For the emails.
Yeah. So let's get right into it with some science. I'm going to begin by debunking a science news story that you've probably already heard of. This involved a quote-unquote woolly mouse. So if you can imagine a woolly mammoth about the size of an African elephant with all this shaggy fur on it and these curved tusks, but instead it's a mouse and it doesn't have tusks. That was the big announcement. The reason I say debunking is because you should not think that this represents really any step toward resurrecting the extinct woolly mammoth, which I would be really excited about. I love megafauna.
Or creating a new species in the lab kind of thing.
Well, they have done, I think, technically that, and that's all they've done. If you take a mouse or any other animal and then genetically modify it in a new, novel way, you've created a different kind of that animal. That's all they've done.
This is not Jurassic Park, is what you're trying to say.
This is not Jurassic Park. Yeah. We're not bringing these animals back. I would love to. There's a bird I really like called the moa, where, Gabe, I think you standing upright, your head would go like to the base of its legs. I'd love to see that. Or the American lion, all these other megafauna. These are mice that have been changed, much in the same way that other livestock have been changed. We talked on the show about a cow that the Brahman cow, it was genetically modified so that for climate change, it would deal with climate change better. How do you do that? You take some of the characteristics of the Brahman cow, which is heat adapted.
The slick hair, yeah.
Yeah, and adapt it. That's what they've done. They went looking for kind of the hair qualities of a mammoth that they could see. Mm-hmm. And how do we change a mouse to mimic that? That's it.
Okay.
But that mouse is nowhere near to an elephant. All these German researchers.
Yeah, there were a lot of stories about this online. What in the you looked into how German scientists view what the science behind what happened?
They're all saying the same thing. It's far away from making a mammoth or a mammoth mouse. It's just a mouse that has some special genes. I'll quote another guy who says, actually, his name's Sergey. He works at Harvard, and I was surprised because his research is funded by the same Dallas, Texas-based company that's worth $10 billion. Hmm. So I thought, this guy's compromised. He has a conflict of interest. He went out and he's like, look, we've been able to breed mice from cultured embryonic cells since 1981, and the first knockout mice were created in 1989, almost 40 years ago. Nothing really new here. So if you want a mouse that looks like this, I think you can buy them or something similar for $3,500. That's the end of the story.
Okay. Well, thanks. We got research out of Sweden on a topic that we covered in depth over a year ago. It was toxic masculinity. We had an interview. What was that guy's name again?
Sterling Cooper.
Sterling Cooper.
Oh, Sterling Cooper. Yeah.
We talked to him at length about misogyny and his influence on young men. That's what this study is about. This is Kristianstad, the University of Kristianstad in Sweden. And there are two different parts here. So the first part, they looked at 2,857 heterosexual men of all ages and backgrounds in Sweden. And they asked them, they presented them a list with well-known manfluencers or toxically masculine influencers. And then they had these people rate the degree to which they agree with the following statements. Women are only worth what they can offer me.
Women are only worth what they can offer. So that's pretty transactional.
Yeah. Women are only a means to an end, and that's the way I treat them.
Okay, so they've watched this content, this video content probably first, and now they're answering them.
They were offered a list of the names of these influencers. To what extent do you follow these influencers?
Are you aware of them and what they say?
Yeah, not only are you aware of them, do you follow them? And then what do you think about those two statements? The more that these people followed the influencers, the greater the extent to which they agree with those statements. I mean, obviously, this is not causation. It's straight up correlation. They could have been misogynistic before, and that's the reason why they're following these people. So you can't, from this part of the experiment, you can't exactly say that these influencers cause people mm-hmm. to think a certain way, but the correlation is certainly there.
Well, and real quick, that correlation is helpful, I would say, mostly for a lot of women out there, right? If you're dating a guy and he's like, oh yeah, by the way, and he starts rattling off these manfluencers,
yeah,
toxically masculine, there's a higher pure correlation, but a higher chance that he holds these debasing, dehumanizing views.
Dehumanizing
toward
women.
Very,
very important word there. All right, part two. 597 Swedish men. First thing is they asked...
You could have said 600. I would have been okay with
597.
That. 597.
Okay. They had to answer the question, I have tried to get a partner, but I have been repeatedly rejected. Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
So have they dealt with repeated rejection from women? Now, they were split into two groups. The first group was presented a fake social media post where it was about how women were threatening men's status, right? Women are earning more than men.
Oh,
they're taking all the leadership positions. The second group saw a social media post about latest scientific research on animals.
Neutral.
Completely neutral.
Control.
Yeah. Then both groups had to answer the question, what percent of sexual harassment cases are made up by women? So they wanted to determine to what extent does a post like that change your opinion on whether women are distrustful?
So you've got four groups here, really. I've been rejected a lot by women, or I haven't been rejected a lot by women. And I've either seen this incendiary post claiming to take away men's status or something totally neutral.
Yeah. The ones who had just read the post saying that women were threatening men's status, oh, that was enough to change their opinion on how mistrustful or distrustful women are.
Even the ones who, the whole group, even the ones who hadn't been rejected previously?
The more you had dealt with being rejected by women, the more you could be influenced by these influencers.
The stronger the effect it's going to. This is they're talking about almost like a causal creation of what is called an incel, right?
Yeah.
The involuntary celibate. Typically a young guy, he's been rejected by women he wants to date, but can't.
Yeah.
And so this kind of content, I don't know, gender dividing inflammatory content has a bigger effect on those guys.
Much bigger, according to this is a small experiment. Only 597 people. They did a third part of the experiment to check if it had more of an effect on younger men, and it did. So, I mean, that's where it goes. There's a connection between young men who have dealt with rejection, taking it out ideologically on women as a whole, the manosphere.
Yeah, and to be aware of it, right? Everyone's going to get rejected. We've all been rejected.
Yeah, but that was the conclusion of the study. First of all, it's called Manfluencers and Young Men's Misogynistic Attitudes. And the message was, look, we have to be better at speaking with young men about rejection because it is leading to much more harmful things when they have to deal with it on their own.
I'll make the last part here very, very quick. And part of it is social media. Mm-hmm. An experiment out of the UK where they took 50 university-age students and they had them either look at Instagram for 15 minutes, and that's where you could come across some of these posts that you're just referencing.
Sure.
Or they read the news and they just measured effectively their heart rate and whether or not they were sweating. And what they found is effectively, or the biggest finding, was that if you're scrolling through Instagram, your heart rate will decrease, your perspiration will go up. Then when you pull away, or the cessation moment, when they say stop right now, I would have thought that whatever's getting like alerted would kind of calm back down. The opposite happens. Your anxiety goes up, your heart rate goes up, your sweating goes up. Everything becomes more agitated. And they're saying that they're very cautious. They said we're not going to call this a 100% clear sign of an addiction, because these people technically didn't have addictive behaviors. We forced them to consume it for 15 minutes. But this is what addiction looks like when you
take it away.
When you stop the drug. So again, this whole system acts on the human body like a drug, like a narcotic, like alcohol. Be aware of that. Other things to be aware of, just at the end here, if you're getting a surgery anytime soon, Gabe, you had a couple. Mm-hmm. Last year, 2024 was kind of...
My mom just had one on her spine.
Don't get it on a Friday.
Why?
Because on the weekends, hospitals tend to have quote-unquote skeleton crews, and your post-operative outcomes drop. This was based on a huge data source, 400,000 patients in Ontario, Canada. They looked at 25 very common surgical procedures, and if you had it on a Friday instead of on a Wednesday or on a Tuesday or a Monday, there was a 10%, I'm kind of rounding it here, but 10% increase in death at 30 days, 90 days, or a year. That's crazy. It's the day of the week. If you get it on a Friday, your odds are 10% higher that in those time frames you are dead.
Wow.
So two solutions here: book it for a different day, or hospitals, hey, can you stop doing those weekend skeleton crews? That'd be the other one. Last thing I'll say here, and this is for really relevant, I think, for audiobook listeners. Gabe, you're one. I'm into them right now. I'm into my second audiobook, actually, of the last 2 months, and I don't like the reader's voice all that much.
Okay.
I just don't. I don't like it as much as the first book.
What can you do?
What can you do about it? According to research out of Tübingen, Germany here, the reason I probably don't like the second voice as much as the first one is it's not as close to my own voice. And they were looking at AI, artificially intelligent voices. We've generated those voices for the show. We took my voice and did that, and it kind of sounded like Connor Dillon was talking like this. Yeah. Didn't really sound like me. But in the future, in not very long, a lot of audiobooks are going to be read to us by artificially intelligent voices.
And the way to make sure that you like it is what? Model it on your own voice?
You're going to end up listening to one that sounds like your voice, because who doesn't love themselves so much that they want to hear their own voice or something similar to it?
Well, you heard it here on Narcissism Unscripted.
That's what the science shows. We're all narcissistic in that way. Any questions, anything else to say, any science we missed, stu@dw.com.
Okay, we got to jump right into this interview. You weren't here.
I was celebrating
Carnival
in Germany. Yeah. And I'd like to make it sound really like intellectual. It's this cultural event with some political critique and all this.
Give us 1, 2, 3 sentences on
it's
what.
It's a beer fest. And I partook this year twice.
And I spent the time speaking about deep thinking. What? No, seriously. What does thinking deeply due to young brains, adolescent brains, because the effect is way, way, way more than I thought. There was an experiment that's been done, a range of experiments that have been done at the University of Southern California. Let's go there right now.
Science Unscripted.
I'm Mary Helen Imordino Yang. I'm a professor of education, psychology, and neuroscience at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles, USA. And I'm the director of the Center for Affective Neuroscience, Development, Learning, and Education, which is CANDLE, where we study how young people and adults make meaning, how we experience our lives, and the neurobiological aspects of that process and what this means for how we can live happier, more fulfilled lives, how we can design schools that are supportive of young people's learning and well-being.
Mary Helen, some of the work that you've done recently was on young kids or adolescents. What was the primary conclusion from that research?
What we primarily found that I think is just astounding, but also on the other hand, completely makes sense and in some ways not surprising, is that the way in which young people think about complex social stories that we shared with them from the world leverages emotional, cognitive, all kinds of attention systems in the brain in ways that actually physically predicts the future growth of their brain. And then that growth in turn predicts how much they like themselves, how happy they are, and how good their relationships are by their own description in young adulthood.
What kind of thinking leads to these benefits that you're talking about? I saw from the study, it's called transcendent thinking. What does that mean? And if you can give us an example, like what would an example of transcendent thinking be?
So transcendent thinking, you could call it what you want. Like we had to come up with some kind of word, but we called it that because it basically involves people moving beyond the current circumstance, right? So one example, we shared with teenagers from inner city Los Angeles, a whole series of true documentary stories about teenagers from around the world, real true things that have happened to kids, and just asked them in a private interview, how does this person's story make you feel? So, for example, one of the stories that we featured in an early version of this experiment featured Malala Yousafzai, right, who was talking about, she was 12 years old at that time, and she was talking with her dad and with a reporter about how she wanted to be a doctor and continue on with her education. But the Taliban was trying to prevent her from doing that and what that meant for her. So what kids did was they invariably reacted to Malala's situation there and then. They said, oh, I feel really bad for that girl. It's going to be very difficult for her. That's not fair. That's not right. I actually need to think beyond just saying it's going to be bad for her and think about, like, wait a minute. Are you telling me that not everybody in the world gets to go to school? Are you saying that everybody who wants to go to school and there are schools there isn't allowed to just because someone else decides that they shouldn't? I never knew that was the case. Maybe I need to really take my own opportunities in school, you know, more seriously and really start to think about how could I work harder in ways that would help take, you know, help the situation for other people maybe, right? So what they've done is they've moved from like that poor girl, I feel really bad for her, to also thinking about, wait a minute, there's a much bigger implication here beyond just that girl that has to do with what does it mean for what's ethical in the world? What does it mean for the way that we should understand the system of education for other people above and beyond the story of that one girl?
And the more that kids or the kids that you were studying thought this way, the more their brains grew? Or what exactly did you observe?
So what we did was we interviewed each kid. Right. 65 kids. We interviewed each kid for 2 hours about a whole series of 40 stories. And then we moved them into what's called the fMRI scanner. So we could scan the blood flow in their brain and look at how their brains were activating and deactivating in these complex dynamic patterns as they thought about each one of the stories again. And what we found first was that when kids thought about the bigger issue for a particular story, when they saw that story while undergoing brain scanning, we saw a particular pattern of brain activation and deactivation in networks of the brain that we know are involved in affect, emotion, the experience of your guts and your viscera, feeling the interior of your body, regulating your attention, expanding your mind beyond the here and now. And those networks that were involved in all these different mental capacities were regulating one another in a pattern of trading off with one another with activations and deactivations that we could statistically recognize trial by trial. So for each story, we could recognize whether or not they had thought in this transcendent way to that story based on the way their brain activities were happening. And then we brought the kids back 2 years later. And what we were able to show, which is quite astounding, is that those networked patterns of thinking that were associated with transcendence to stories, the more a kid did that and used these networks in real time in front of us during the first scan, the more those networks would be connected to each other robustly, no matter what your brain development was when you came in the first time. And no matter what your IQ was when you came in the first time, if you grappled with these bigger issues, if you asked questions, if you were curious about why it's that way, if you tried to think about the bigger issue, then when you came back 2 years later, we could predict that compared to who your brain was 2 years before, you would have grown yourself more.
What I think you are trying to say here is that it's not some kind of a priori inherent capacity that you're born with, but that you can train it. There are people, there are people listening to this interview right now all over the world that I'm assuming could then also train their brains, even if they're not age 14 or 15 or 16. How should they train their brains to think in this transcendent way, Mary Helen?
Stop doing the things that interfere with this kind of thinking. So save time to take away those kinds of quote-unquote entertainments and goal-directed things that are actually distracting you from these processes, and make sure to reserve space and time to engage in this kind of deep reflective thinking. So you can do it while you're washing the dishes or taking a shower. You can do it with friends quietly having dinner, you know, reflecting and talking with a slow-paced conversation where you're really kind of engaging with ideas together and telling stories and moving into these spaces. You can do it by just taking a walk with your dog and giving yourself the headspace to kind of reflect. But when you sort of default to, you know, externally derived attention, you know, catching stuff that entertains you as your way of relaxing or resting, what you're really doing is training your brain to tip itself outward, so to speak, looking out versus looking in. And over time, what that does is it makes looking in, right, which is that's my sort of code speak for this kind of narrative thought where you're building these bigger, more transcendent ways of understanding things and grappling with ideas. You're making that not have a lot of muscle, so to speak, and it feels empty. You know, the neural system that is very involved in that is one of the most metabolically expensive tissues in the human body. It uses more glucose and oxygen per unit space than the same size tissue in your thigh muscle in the middle of running a marathon, right? Thinking and the brain takes a lot of energy. And so you need to get adequate sleep and rest and nutrition to be able to fuel those parts of your brain. If you are sleep deprived, then those parts of your brain are some of the first to show the effects.
I've got three daughters, the eldest of which, Ava, is 12. She's a little bit younger than the participants were in your study, but I'm wondering now, I mean, I don't really want her to be so out of touch with reality that she's walking down the street and is so lost in thought that she doesn't know that she's going through a red light or something like that. But how could I help her to start thinking in some of the ways that you're talking about, some of the ways that will help build her brain as she, yeah, progresses onward towards maturity? And yeah, how can I help her?
So you hit the nail on the head, right? So what a real mature, developed, functional person can do is not just stay in this headspace all the time of deeply reflecting about the meaning and then walk through a red light and get hit by a bus, right? You have to recognize the appropriate form of mental activity and attention for the situation you're in. And that takes experience. So what you really want to do with your daughter is, first of all, help her learn to manage herself well in the modern world. Some social media and friends and stuff is great, but then you also want to have times when that's off, right? Where you're just with your friends talking, playing, being yourselves, right? Or you want to make sure that it's absolutely off at night. It's your phone is not in your room at night, right? Like those are very basic strategies. Turn it off, stick it in the kitchen, you know, plug it in so it's ready for tomorrow, but you're done now. It's 8 p.m. We're not on phones anymore, right? So that you really set out the space for her to be able to engage in these things. And then kids naturally will do it, right? They love to make meaning out of stuff. I mean, this is what adolescents do. I mean, these are not just my shoes that I just bought, my new shoes for school. These are a statement about what kind of music I like and what kind of friends I have and what kind of aspirations I have for myself and what I believe in about global sustainability and blah, blah, you know, like everything, right? Like teenagers are deeply driven to do this kind of thinking. And we have sort of undermined their opportunities for that because, frankly, we're frightened to let them really go there. But what you want to do for your 12-year-old daughter is go there with her, model it, and rein her in a little bit. Think about, hey, Ava, we're walking down the street. Like, pay attention. There's people behind you. There's a red light up there. You can't just have your head in the clouds, honey. Like, let's watch where we're going. But then also there are times when, you know, it's Saturday morning. We're just going to go sit at the park and just like, you know, we're going to talk about what's going on in your life, or you're going to think about what you saw in the news and like, let's talk with your friends about it. Or we're just going to kind of be here now thinking about things in a safe space to do that, and modeling that for her, modeling the conversations, you know, and not just filling up the space. You have a long car ride or something. Don't just turn on a movie in the back seat, right? have a conversation about stuff or just be silent and think in your own minds about what's going on. And inherent in that is developing a kind of tolerance for not knowing, tolerance for complexity. And so many adults even don't develop a tolerance for those kinds of thoughts and stories. And that undermines their proclivity toward transcendent thinking, because real transcendent thinking is about grappling with the complexities of whatever it is you're thinking about and not just settling quickly into a very concrete, specific answer that that doesn't really represent all the nuance of the reality that exists.
Mary Helen Immordino Yang, speaking to me there from her office in Southern California, and that was a lot to unpack.
It fits.
It fits, though. It, just in order to grasp all of that, I think you already have to be thinking deeply.
And she gave a few examples. There are so many. I mean, sit down with a novel from a very different perspective. Talk, yeah. How many times, if you do sit with a kid or your kid, usually your kid, these questions that come up? Hey, Papa, what was the worst situation that you've been in? It's like, well, what? Yeah, right. Like, just I mean, I guess that's not quite the same, because there you're reflecting on something that happened and not like a.
Heidi turned 6, and she was crying the other day, and I said, "Why are you crying?" And she says, "Because I'm gonna have to move out someday." I was like, well, hey, you're only 6. And then she says, well, yeah.
Well, what did you tell her?
No, I said, no, you can stay in here forever.
Yeah.
You can stay here forever. And then she says, no, because you're going to heaven.
Oh, no.
And then I was like, oh boy, no. What do I do now? No. What do I do now? What do I do? Where's Mary Immordino Yang to take over?
Did you tell her you're not going to heaven? You're going to the one downstairs?
I said, I'm going to the bus station. I'll be back. I'll be back later in the day.
No, yeah. Like you said, lots to unpack there. What are your favorite ways, I guess, for our listeners out there to reach that level of transcendence? I know what she means. It's harder to define how to get there, but I know exactly what she means. When you stop and you go, huh, I never thought about it that way.
Yeah. What's your guys' huh moment? Or where do you go to get to that huh? SU@DW.com.
DW, made for minds.